All right, so I'm sitting here with Scott Fife of the Industrial Workers of the World. Right?
Hi, yep, Scott Fife, right here.
So how did you get into the IWW?
Well, what happened is April Glaspie, she told Saddam Hussein that they didn't have any, the U.S. had no interest in a border dispute between Iraq and Kuwait, and gave him the green light, and then Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. And I got into activism because I was worried about the first Gulf War in 1991. So that was my baptism into activism. Before that, I was just an armchair activist, and I'd see things on TV and get upset, but I never did anything about it.
And then you're a socialist?
With some reservations. I'd call myself a libertarian socialist, which is I don't necessarily believe in government doing everything. I think the local level is where things need to be centered, and I guess that's where I'm at.
Well, so you talk about the first Iraq war with, and that was George Bush Sr.
Yes.
Right, and then so why do you suppose he left Saddam Hussein in power?
I think they needed a boogeyman. I think that there was, it was a good excuse because we were coming to an end of the Cold War to keep the whole military-industrial complex in place, and you know, it was just it was a lot of oil politics, regional kind of confrontations. They were trying to keep things upset in the Middle East. You know, before that, they've been supporting both sides in the Iraq and Iran war, which cost over 1 million lives, and they're playing both sides against each other. So,
just for oil extraction and weapon sales.
Yeah, and regional politics.
So we're talking during at the peak, what I guess we could call the peak of the COVID-19 epidemic.
Well, we don't know that because when they had the 1918 Spanish flu incident, it wasn't the first wave that got the most of the people. It was the second. People kind of let their guard down, and then it came through.
Well, yeah, I want to get into that more because I think that's what's going to happen during the winter, this winter. But it's right before May Day, and so what was going on? What was being talked about for May Day demonstration-wise?
Well, we were going to have some events here. There wasn't necessarily going to be a demonstration. I know that there's other people in other cities that were going to do something. We were going to have you know, a lot of gatherings. We were going to do a couple of film showings and, you know, definitely have a soapbox, but everything kind of got canceled as a result of this.
Well, yeah, and you do a monthly,
the first
movie thing at McNeil Riley?
Yeah, first Monday of the month at 7 p.m. And the second Monday of the month at McNeil Riley House, which is on 13th and Jefferson, we have our meeting. I'm sorry, the second Wednesday. It's the first Wednesday is the movie, the second Wednesday is the meeting.
And so what goes on at the movie? Is there talking or just...
Well, we introduce the movie and then afterwards people talk about the movie and that's usually a pretty interesting conversation. We show a lot of, you know, documentaries, but we also show fictionalized accounts of real things and things to make people think about stuff, you know, think about politics and their situation in the world right now.
What kind of turnout are you getting?
Depends on the movie. We showed one movie about where a town took over their, in Mexico, took over their town from the cartels and who were also logging on their property, which they thought was, you know, that threatened their livelihood because they got to a point where they're going to log around this spring that supplied five different communities with water. And so the people just rose up and they took back their area. They went back to a more of a tribal thing, pre-Columbian type of government, more along anarchist lines that where everybody makes the decisions. And it was a real success and a way to take back, you know, power. And so that one was a really popular one, and we had to move the tables out of the main room where we show the movies so that there was enough room to have everybody sit. So I guess it depends on the subject, it depends on the weather, but... We're also organizing in places. We're organizing this place called PenFed. It's the Pentagon Federal Credit Union. So that was one of our successes here in town. And anybody that wants to organize, they can come to our meeting. It's the second Wednesday of the month. I'm not quite sure when they're going to reconvene it, but probably, you know, in the next couple of months.
And it's always right there. I can't think of the name of that building.
McNeil Riley.
Oh, it is McNeil Reilly.
Yeah, both of them are there now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, not anymore. It used to be over there on Charlton, I thought.
Yeah, well, it was over in the Whitaker at the cafe, World Cafe, so. But we had, sometimes in rooms like that, it's hard for older people to hear because there's so much ambient noise.
Well, and so I know, I've heard Free Angela Davis was mentioned again. You just played that one, and I've just heard that referenced because that was a critical demonstration for prison reform.
Yeah, that and the Attica Uprising, they're both really critical. Things changed for the better, but now things, it seems like, have gotten worse. And of course, you've got the private prisons, which, you know, I think anything like that shouldn't be for profit. And we need to think about, we just had one of our members who's going back to jail for 10 years. He has a habit that should be treated as a health issue, heroin, but instead he's, you know, sent 10 years on the taxpayer's dime. That seems like a big waste.
Right, and it's a punitive rather than a restorative model.
Yeah, and it's just, this is a health concern. You know, other countries have done that. Portugal, they legalized all the drugs. I'd be a little worried when it comes to something like crystal meth because people can act so crazy. But, you know, it's just a way, especially that would be a way to beat the cartels and all this, you know, gangs in Africa and everything. If we can take the profit motive out of the drugs, then you can really, you know, turn things around with the drug war.
Well, it would be cheaper for the taxpayer.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
And the money wouldn't go to the prison industrial complex, corporations.
No. And you know, the police, the prisons, even the prisons that are run by the state, you know, they like to keep the numbers up there. And I don't know, you hear about the coronavirus cases that are going through the prison, and that's really sad. And, you know, you're locked in there and you don't have an option. Today I was reading in the paper, and where was it? But they made these people sign a document that they wouldn't be sued, and then they gave them the mask. They weren't given the mask unless they signed the document. It was at one of the detention centers on the border for immigrants.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned crystal meth, because I've been looking into legalizing drugs. I did a... There's police. The police actually are in favor of legalizing drugs. I called them. I talked to them.
Some.
They're called LEAP.
A police group. Not
yeah,
all police.
Law enforcement. Right. Not all police. No. This was law enforcement against. I forget what the acronym was, but anyway. I'm wondering though, what would you do? I suppose with crystal meth, these are people that have a disease that is, an addiction is a disease. It's not, they're not born criminals. So if worse came to worse, you could just, they should be in an institution of some kind, like a mental institution with good care. I mean, I wouldn't be against that.
Yeah, that seems like a way, but just putting them in a, you know, putting them in a jail and throwing away the key, that doesn't seem the thing to do. But what worries me is just how much power the cartels have. There's places in Mexico where the cartels control it. The police are afraid to go in there, and they've been killed. And they have an amazingly advanced weaponry, too, because they're getting all this money off of the illegality of drugs.
Well, and I asked Leap if he had any information. I thought the cartels actually influence our legislatures here, but I don't have any evidence of that.
You know, and that's what I wonder. If the high reaches of government, there might be some collusion with, you know, I don't know about that, but I know there's a book called Snowblind, and it was basically how the U.S. government has been involved with dealing drugs for a very long time on the high level. So it's a way that the CIA can have funds outside of the, you know, that Congress doesn't have to approve. And so they, you know, initially it was the OSS, which was the predecessor to the CIA during World War II. When they were in Italy, you know, fighting Mussolini, they got into Sicily, and they saw that the Sicilians were running drugs, and that's when it first started. But there's a book called Snowblind that kind of talks about this whole history of drugs in the U.S. government. You know, the Ali North basically was taking guns down to Honduras for the Contras, and he was taking cocaine back, you know.
Well, and then there's The Politics of Heroin, was another famous book, and, you know, the opium wars.
Yeah, I mean, that was the first drug war. The Chinese wanted to get rid of opium, and the British brought their gunship up to the Imperial Temple and fired on it until they relented. And might have something to do with our politics. With, they call that the 100 years of humiliation in China, about how, what their position is now.
All right, and so getting back to the industrial workers of the world, what is the history of labor? What can you tell me about the history of labor in this country and the industrial workers of the world?
Well, this country actually had some of the most fierce labor wars in the world when we started trying to unionize. As far as May Day goes, it was basically people were trying to get an 8-hour day, and the politicians, and I guess the politicians were the tools of the corporations, and they were fighting against it. What happened? They were gathered at Haymarket Square in Chicago, and everybody was kind of broken up by the end of the rally. And then somebody threw a bomb, and it killed a few policemen. And so then they gathered up 8 different leaders of the anarchist movement. I hate to even use that word leader, but facilitators, whatever you want to use. But they put them on trial and found them guilty. But some of them weren't even there, and the whole thing was kind of gone down. So people don't know if it was, you know, if it was a saboteur or if it was, you know, somebody. With the police department, it was never really verified. But eventually, three of them were hanged. One of them committed suicide in prison. And 4 of them were later pardoned by the governor of Illinois, and it cost him his political career.
Well, and just like 9/11, it was awfully convenient for, whether if the police didn't do it, it was definitely convenient for them, method for them to get the anarchists out of circulation.
Yeah, it set back the 8-hour workday for quite a while to have that happen. And I don't think it came around until, that was like 1890s, and it didn't come around again until 1930 with Roosevelt and the New Deal.
Right, and May Day, I didn't realize May Day started at the Haymarket.
Yeah, actually, what was funny is we were one of the first countries to that's where May Day started, is the United States, and I think we in Canada are the only ones that don't have that official celebration, you know.
Right, it is a worldwide celebration.
Yeah, there's some obscure LaborNet event associated with the Labor Day that we have, but, you know, and the communists, they kind of used it, the totalitarian communists, I should say, they used it as a way to run tranks in the streets and show off their military might, but really it comes down to, you know, people. You have more in common with your fellow worker in another country than you do with your own leader, and they have more in common with you than they do with their leader. So we've really got to, you know, that's part of the industrial workers of the world preambles, that we're really, you know, as long as you're a worker, then, you know, that's where it matters.
Well, so do you think people were about to take to the streets, though, before this COVID thing hit?
Well, there sure has been a lot of you know, angst. I mean, I don't think there would have been a Bernie campaign the way it happened if it hadn't been for Occupy. And I think that was a result of, you know, initially it was a result of the bailout of the banks, you know. At first it was bailed out by Bush, and then another second bailout was done by Obama after he got into power. And I just heard today that they wanted to add another $250 billion onto the bill for this whole COVID recovery.
Well, and I want to get into that more. One other thing real quick, too, I'm kind of springing this on you, so if you don't want to answer it, we'll edit it out. But I've heard, what is it with the IWW and other groups, that they don't get involved with other groups? Is that a policy?
No, we work with the NAC as a sister or neighborhood anarchist committee, is it?
Coalition.
Yeah, we work with them as a group, but, you know, it's basically what we won't get involved with politics. That was the very first split, and it happened a year after the IWW was founded. The socialists wanted to, you know, support candidates, and we just thought that's way too divisive, and usually, you know, politicians will sell you out, you know. So, you know, it just seemed like aligning yourselves with politicians. I mean, you can see, you know, everybody puts their faith in the next politician, then he sells you out, and then they look for another politician instead of looking at the whole idea of representative government as opposed to direct democracy, is what we have. You know, we ask people, are we in a democracy? And, you know, they'll say, well, the rich have power, well, the corporations have power, but really we have a republic, which a republic is basically you elect a representative and they represent you.
Well, and see, that's why I wonder if, you remember in 68, we had the Democratic National Convention where Abby Hoffman and those guys,
demonstrated outside, basically.
Yeah, because they didn't like who the DNC was choosing.
Yeah, they were, this whole thing was so engineered with Bernie's defeat. I mean, I didn't see one positive story in the press about Bernie. Lots of negative stories. They'd either ignore him or it'd be a negative story about Bernie for weeks leading up to when he decided to bow out. And I think that was a concerted effort, because they wanted their corporate candidate. And I don't know anybody who can get excited about Biden. I can't get excited about him. And he just seems like, and there's revelations coming out. And this should have came out. I was really mad at the Register Guard for not getting this out. But there was a woman who was a intern for Biden, and she said that Biden grabbed her. He stuck his fingers up inside of her. And then when she pushed him off, he said, "You're nothing to me." And she said that was almost what hurt the most. And she's been carrying that around. But now she's coming out and talking about this. And so it's like, God, you don't want to. Either one of these guys are pretty disgusting.
I heard that too. And it's funny that they came out with that after Bernie had already decided not to.
I saw in the papers, though, a couple of weeks before. But it never made it into the mainstream media until after Bernie decided to, endorse Biden.
But yeah, I'm glad you brought this up because I've been saying this for weeks. That even NPR, they're saying that they need a moderate and that Bernie is too far to the left. Well, and that's not true. The youth vote is what got Obama elected.
Okay, yeah, look at this. Okay, let's break down the election. Okay, they said, last year that, we had this big overwhelming thing for Trump or this big overwhelming thing for Hillary. I mean, 4 years ago. And basically what happens, okay, let's look at this. So half the people don't vote. We're now down to, 50% of people vote. So that's said something in and of itself.
Oh, yeah, it was at 30%.
But this is, say, half the people didn't vote. So half the people, there's probably 1% that voted for Jill Stein and 1% that voted for the Libertarian. And so then you're down to 24%. And then I heard on those polls that, that when they left the thing, one third of those 24, 8, percent, didn't vote for Hillary, voted for Hillary because he wasn't Trump, and another third of that 24 voted for Trump because he wasn't Hillary. So now we're down to 18% of the people, and that's not, an overwhelming majority. I mean, I think it would be really even more fair if we had, something like this winner-takes-all system. You can get, 49.9% voted to 51.1%, and then they get to choose how we run the country. Like in a parliament system, if you have so many Greens, if you have so many Conservative Party, so many, you all be represented in the Congress. So that's where I think that things should go.
Instead of having a small group of people decide for everyone. Majority rules, but it's a minority of a majority. Well, and Joe Rogan came out and endorsed Bernie Sanders too right before there, because, and to me, that's, there is a small section of the white middle class that would have gone for Bernie.
Well, that's the thing, is people were just so fed up last election, and they remember when they said that Jeb Bush was going to be the anointed one. And everybody was thinking that they were saying that was a sure thing. And then what do we find out? People are fed up. And so they voted for the maverick, Trump. And we saw, I've never seen a rally as excited as I was when I was over in Springfield for Bernie. And it was just like he was a rock star or something. And people really were excited. Instead, the Democrats, and this was shown by WikiLeaks, is that they threw the primary to Hillary. And, it basically stole the primary. The DNC, and so...
Right, that's not conspiracy theory. That's been documented.
That's been documented, yeah.
The Biden, I call him I call him Delaware Joe. He's the Duke of Delaware, where corporations go to spawn,
Yeah, you look at any sort of, junk mail, credit card mail, it's all from Delaware.
Right, and he's their representative, and then... I'm predicting right now that if he gets in there, I will vote for him. I'll grit my teeth and vote for him. But if he gets in there, you will have a war in three different places: the Ukraine, and Central or in South America and Iran. And, you know, the Russians are not going to give up Ukraine. It's a major, there's a major port in there. So that's just not going to happen.
Yeah, you know, I personally don't put a lot of faith in leaders. I think if Bernie got in there and did the stuff that he did, I'd hope he'd have a good president because he probably should be shot. I hate to say that, but just there's a lot of forces in this world and they're not ready to give up power. I mean, this whole coronavirus is just showing us, you know, what kind of world we could actually have. We really need to be, you know, working to live instead of living to work. I mean, we're doing so many jobs. Some of the jobs aren't just, you know, they're dangerous to the planet. If you're making weapon manufacturing, that's a problem, you know. And so and other jobs that are just kind of inane. I mean, we need jobs for survival. We need jobs for, you know, a little bit more. But really, we should be working to eat and living a lot more simple than we have. You see the comeback of animals in a lot of these wild places, absence of the humans. And places like Delhi, India, they're starting to see the sky, you know, that they'd never seen for years. People see blue skies. I mean, it's just an amazing thing. And it was just a matter of, you know, living a little lighter.
Well, you said that you thought he would be shot. I kind of feel that they would have done something to him. But I was hoping he was going to run Ocasio-Cortez as his vice.
That would be great. And I think, you know, one thing we got to keep in mind is that, you know, you can still vote for Bernie. His name is going to be on here. And I'd be really happy if he came in first here, even though he won't be the candidate, you know. But then, because then when it comes time for the convention, hopefully, you know, a lot of our ideas will get out there.
Well, so when I mentioned Ocasio-Cortez, she was just on this, last night, I think it was. And they put her on Friday, you know, when no one listens to the news. And she was saying that this whole COVID, the whole bailout has basically been a giveaway once again to the corporations.
I don't doubt it. I mean, the last bailout was, I mean, it was amazing when they had the bailout in 2008. You know, the next year that just, you know, 6 months down the road, they were giving these guys huge bonuses. It's like, wait, what's this? You know, and that was what, you know, that I moved here from Salt Lake and in Utah, and they had a senator that, you know, usually they're senators for life until they step down. And that's how it goes. But this guy, there was such a, at the Republican convention, he got kicked out during the primary and they kept calling him Bailout Bob, you know, because so it's, that's really something that unites us and the right together is just this, you know, corporate welfare.
The middle class, the white middle class doesn't want to see this either.
Yeah, it's just been, and that's, I wondered how much pork it is. I mean, they're giving, what, people $1,500? Big deal. That's not even a month's rent and food, you know?
Well, so what should it look like? For one thing, what about 15 and 30-hour work weeks?
That would be good. I mean, we really, I mean, right now with the whole climate issue, climate chaos, we really need to be gearing the whole society in a different direction. It has to be as radical as the New Deal. Which was, and maybe this will happen here, but that was Norman Thomas. He was the socialist candidate for president for quite a few years. And a lot of those ideas, social security, 8-hour workday, were things that he was promoting. And, you know, basically what Roosevelt said is we're saving capitalism from itself. And I wouldn't want to have seen us go over to like a totalitarian type of capitalism where they had like in you know, in Russia and China, but, you know, so I don't know if we were ready then to go over, but it seems like we've got to have some way that we've got to step down and we really got to change our focus so it's not all about making money. This whole COVID thing is really illustrating where we are as a society. It's kind of laying everything bare and, you know, it's...
We're like a third world country. We're on the road to it very quickly.
Yep.
Well, but, you know, what is it? In the Scandinavian countries, you know, they say that they're socialists. My observation is they have oil reserves there. And instead of giving the profits from the oil reserves to a small oligarchy, they spread it out among the people. And that's why everybody gets, from the North Sea oil, everybody gets a check. From the, and in Alaska too, they get
Alaska,
a check
yep.
from. So I'm not advocating this, but what about that? Where I shouldn't have to work for, I should be able to get. I can justify getting a check because you're taking resources from a country that I belong to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, people, I think it was Yang that was talking about a...
universal basic income. I'm talking with Scott Fife of the Industrial Workers of the World on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Community Radio, simulcast on KEPW.org. A monthly stipend.
Yeah, and that's what it was. That was the idea.
Well, what would finance that, though, in this country? Besides, I mean, all we make is weapons.
Oh, well, yeah, you know, the thing is that we are in such a... Our finances are in such a junk. We have a huge national debt. We have a huge foreign debt. And, you know, and a lot of it's owned by China, so it's going to be amazing when it's time to pay the piper because we don't have the money. We're just creating money out of thin air, you know, and it's like at some point in time that's going to got to give, and I don't know if this is going to be the thing that does it, you know.
Well, you see, and they say there's no inflation, but I notice your money is not going to be worth anything if they keep doing this way.
No, it's not.
Things are costing. Do you notice higher prices?
Well, not for gas, but yeah. Things have just been creeping up. I mean, it's like the squeeze, you know. Rent goes up, and then this goes up, and your wage isn't going up at the same time. So it's just like, you know, people are feeling like a crunch, you know. And if you get enough of a squeeze, eventually things burst. And, you know, you'd like to see a revolution where it's not a lot of violence like the French Revolution. And I don't think it would happen in this country, but you have like in Egypt where you have a theocracy take over. And that's a scary thing. But if you got enough knowledge base into people, that can happen. But right now, I think we wouldn't be ready for a general strike or a revolution just because Americans are just... I think it was Jack London that said, you know, we're a nation of temporarily embarrassed millionaires.
Well, yeah, and you know, it's bread and circuses. I thought that was Machiavelli said that as long as you give people just enough bread and entertainment to live on, that they won't revolt.
And that's what they say. But you know, that's and we are also into our handheld devices. People are watching the computer all the time. Television is still a factor, and so some of it people just don't want to know, you know, and they'd rather have live their life. And as long as my life's going fine, then you know, I'm not going to get involved in these other issues.
Right, and you'll just have gated communities like in Soylent Green.
We'll have gated communities now here in Eugene. I drive past it all the time, and it's, you know, but people can scale a gate.
Even though it would probably be cheaper for them to pay people more money, and this is just a sustainability thing. You know, have you ever read Francis Moore LePay? If you give people social services, the birth rate actually goes down. The birth rate in Italy and places like that in the developed world has actually gone down. So you really want to give people social services for your own good.
Well, that's part of it, but also it's the education of women, the value of women, women's access to birth control and abortions. You know, that's part of it, too.
All right, so, and then you want to get into, I don't know if, you know, the mutual aid societies have sprung up everywhere. I have a lot of hope with that.
Yeah, there's one in Eugene. Have you heard about that?
A little bit.
Yeah, I haven't.
I don't know how to, they just have a Facebook. I don't do Facebook.
I don't do Facebook either.
And that's the only way to contact them, so that's my problem with them.
I have a link, though, and a number that I could give you, or an email that if you wanted to interview them, it's kind of off the record here, but yeah.
All right, well, then we won't record that part, but, so what are they doing?
Just making sure what most people are just doing, you know, what happens after a disaster is people just try to take care of each other. It's amazing how people get, you know, will help each other. I'm helping my neighbor. She's like 76 and she's immobile. She has problems with walking. And so I go and get her groceries, get her mail for her. And I mean, and that's just, I've heard about that all over the country, that kind of stuff is happening. People, they needed face masks. People, you know, the government didn't have enough, so people were sewing all the face masks. I mean, that's what happened in, you know, after any earthquake or that. People, I guess, had this innate desire. I don't know if you ever heard this book called Tribe?
No.
Okay, Tribe is basically about kind of that thing is that people, well, one of the premises is that people want to be a part of community. And we are so separated with our handhelds or devices, with our television, everybody's into their own space, and they're not really communicating. Like, you know, now they don't even build porches on houses. And people used to sit on their porch, and they talk to their neighbors, And, you know, we've become so isolated in ourselves. But anyway, basically what they said is, like, back in the colonial times, they couldn't figure this out because people would, if a Native American was captured by the white people, as soon as they could get out, they'd run back to their tribe. But if a white person was captured by the Native Americans, they wouldn't want to go back because they felt that sense of community. And that's really puzzled people at the time because they thought, well, they have these luxuries, they have this and that. And they also talked about after war, when people go to war, there was a real kinship between these men, even though a lot of times they were doing pretty horrid things. And when they got back home, they didn't feel that same, you know, kinship with their other people. And so it was hard for them that's another factor when people come back from war. And he talked about, you know, the British government was learning about how to trade, you know, how to train people. And after this is during the bombing of London and the bombing of the major cities in England during World War II. And what was happening, they didn't need to be, they just self-organized and helped each other out. The government's fears were completely out of bounds. They thought people would be going at each other's throats, but no, people were pulling together and making sure that everybody was, you know, cared for.
Well, and so, and this has happened after hurricanes too. I'm trying to think.
I mean, God, Katrina, that was one. It's like, you know, the government was kind of missing in action. And, you know, I've met, there's people here in town that were down that they're helping make shift kitchens and stuff like that. I mean, the government wasn't to be seen. Or when they finally did come along, it was, you know, too little, too late.
Well, and so that's what I'm hoping is going to happen, is their own arrogance is going to bring them down.
Hubris is what they call
it. Yeah, hubris. And, you know, victory gardens and growing your own food.
That's a good thing. That's a good thing about Eugene. That's one of the reasons I moved here. They have, like, a lot more organic gardens in a lot of places. What happened in Cuba is after the fall of the Soviet Union, I mean, they still have what they have, which is a sort of a dictatorship. But what happened, there's a great movie called Peak Oil, The Power of Community, and we've shown it at IWW. But basically it was after the Soviet Union fell, they were growing a cash crop, sugar, for the Soviet Union, so they didn't have that coming in. And that's who they were aligned with. And so they had to, they said everybody lost about 20 pounds. But eventually they got to a point where they instead of having three central colleges, they have 50 colleges all around the island, and they have more bikes per capita than any other country, and they have more organic gardens. I mean, Havana is like 7 million people, so that's, you know, but you had to feed yourself. There's another great movie called The Take, and it's about after the Argentinian dollar collapsed. And so what basically happened, this is a movie by Naomi Klein, and she is how everybody just came together and they fed themselves, and they went back and took over the factories. In fact, the movie's about one factory that they took over, and then the owner wanted to come back and take it back, but the rich all fled because the country was falling down. But the people got together and they made things happen and saved it. But then ultimately in the movie, what they're undoing was electoral politics once again.
Well, and that was in Sustainability and Resistance. There's a book called Sustainability and Resistance. They talk about Cuba and several other countries the same way you're saying, where they just started growing their own food, and it expanded from there and created a community around the community gardens. Well, but so do you suppose that this would cause a strike, though, that these mutual aid societies would be there for us to get through a strike?
Are you talking a general strike?
Yeah, or even, you know, Lonnie, other guy, is it? Can we mention his name, Lonnie Douglas from the IWW? He was saying about a countywide strike.
It could happen. I'm going to be interesting to see what happens on May 1st if people do this rent strike I've heard people talking about. But, you know...
Well, so what do you think is going to happen? What direction are we going?
Okay, what's happening is, so they're not necessarily, you know, letting people skip. They're just letting their people skip their rent. So now the next month comes along, you know, because she said the eviction freeze, but then you have to pay twice as much rent, and you still don't have a job. I mean, does that really help you out? What I think should have happened with this thing is just say freeze everything. So that means freeze all people's rent, freeze the landlord if they're buying the place. Their payments,
the mortgage,
the mortgage for that.
Well, they've given them a forbearance, but the banks are balking at it. But they are getting a forbearance.
What's the forbearance?
Well, they pay at the end of the loan. They tag it on to the end of the loan. So you have to come up with money for rent. They don't have to come up with money. They may sell the place long before they have to come up with that money at the end of the loan.
Okay.
So, but you as a renter are going to have to, like you say, it's going to be a balloon payment that you're going to have to come up with, or add it to, you know, add $100 a month to your rent until you pay it off. And they'll charge you interest probably. A corporate renter will probably charge you interest.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's the only, if you just freezed everything off around across the board, and then the only thing that would be missing would be some interest on the part of the banks, you know, and who cares? I mean, those guys make obscene amounts of money. Even with Selco, who's my bank, the guy that's the president of the bank, he makes $700,000. I mean, and right. This is a credit union.
Yeah. Oh, is that right? No, but what I'm getting at is, what do you think? So now everybody's going to be pissed, okay, because of what you're saying. What's going to happen? They're going to further extract money out of the economy and give it to corporations. So there's going to be a further disparity of wealth in the country. What's the symptoms? What's that going to look like?
Well, I read a story and
no health care and no services for the homeless, basically.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but now they're doing things that it seemed like in Eugene anyway. They're a little more compassionate. I know they let people shelter in place. I've been seeing, you know, camps and places where they would immediately got run off, but.
How did they do that, though? People went in and demanded. People went in down to the city council and demanded it.
Is that, I don't know how that happened, but I think it's just that they were worried that, you know, if they kept kicking them out, maybe they're worried about their own health. I don't know.
Right, the disease would spread if they didn't.
Yeah, that's part of it.
All right. Well, so I don't remember what we were talking about. Lonnie Douglas also was a countywide strike.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I really don't think people have enough of an education. What we really do need to do is, educate people about what a society would look like after this. You got to have a kind of an end goal in mind, not just go into a revolution, you know, without that.
Well, now, I've been saying that for quite a while, and the anarchists, I've asked anarchists what that looks like, and they will not give me an answer. But, I mean, we can see it with these mutual aid societies.
Yeah, decentralization is a lot of it, you know.
Decentralization.
And that's the one thing, that's one of the things in those communist countries they didn't have. It was all centralized bureaucracy. But
in Cuba, though, the medical stuff, the they have small little clinics in each township or each village.
Uh-huh.
And I can see the mutual aid societies would be a place for education. They could free school at the mutual aid society and free medical at the mutual aid society. And the doctor wouldn't be rich, but they would have. But what I'm worried about is how would you, for instance, the ventilators? How would the mutual aid societies produce ventilators? Or equipment like that, or, you know, necessary equipment.
You'd have to have some sort of way of doing that. I don't know. The ventilators, they only have a 50% survival rate if you go on a ventilator. And
And if you ate right and healthy and had preventative medicine, you wouldn't need as much equipment.
Yeah, that's true. And there's also a fetishization of life here, where we keep people alive way longer, you know, sometimes than they should be. You know, it's just like, I know from a lot of people that I've talked to, they kind of said to when their parents' life came to an end, you know, they just kind of wish that they could go, you know, quicker, and it wasn't all keeping them alive. You know, they had those living wills that, you know, they don't want kicking out the cord the next day, but, you know, if you're just alive by a machine, then what kind of life is that, you know? And with those ventilators, when you come off them, there's a lot of long-term effects from those, so you got to be careful with that too.
Well, you know, we have these maker spaces too that you could do a lot of stuff. You could have cell phones and a rudimentary communications system and still be an anarchist without a central corporation making these things.
Yeah, but every technology has a waste, and it has a lot of, you have to extract resources in the beginning. So there's that factor. But, you know, some people talked about maybe in the future we'll go back into the dumps and start pulling stuff out, and because we buried a lot of stuff in those, that pottery could be helpful.
Yeah, but I see it as there's appropriate technology. First of all, you should be able to repair anything. You should not have to go to a third party to have something repaired. You should be able to, you or your neighbor or someone in the close by should be able to repair it. If not, then it's too complicated.
Yeah, I had a little space heater and they had the screws in them, so you could, and I know how to fix them. And they had the screws in there, so you couldn't unscrew it. The screws only went in one way, so you could screw them in, but you couldn't back them out.
Well, and see, even cars, I'm not advocating the cars be a good technology. I'm just using it as an example. And diesel trucks, the original trucks in the 50s and 60s and the cars in the 50s and 60s, they were meant to be rebuilt by you. Even television sets, when they first came out, and computers, were all meant to be repaired by you.
Well, yeah, now it's such a cheap... there's so many cheap stuff flooding the market, which isn't very well made either. And it just breaks down. You just go and get a new one. The other one goes in the dump, you know.
Right. And cars, too. They just crush them. They don't even take... sometimes they don't even take the parts off them. They just crush them.
Yeah, it's gotten really bad with the built-in obsolescence.
What... All right, so anything else you want to talk about?
I don't know. How long have we got it? How long is on there?
Well, I don't know. This will go on for quite a while, but it's probably been about an hour. You know, I've got written down... we already talked about Ocasio-Cortez and the bailout. I've got written down Keynes versus Milton Friedman.
Okay.
Is supply-side economics versus Keynesian. You touched on that a little bit.
You know, well, I mean, I want to talk about... I think disaster capitalism is a good thing to talk about, because it just seems like... this is just every time one of these comes along, it's a way for corporations to, and the rich, already rich, to grab even more power. I mean, that whole thing, you know, what was weird is they said too big to fail, and you make them bigger, that with the banks, it's like, well, what's the logic there? You know, now we have even more people and, you know, fewer hands, and more wealth into fewer hands. And I thought that was, I couldn't understand the logic of that at all.
Right. I didn't see that coming, where they would actually... In this case, they basically caused a problem from lack of funding and inner health care and oversight, and then they're going to make money off of fixing the problem, just like they did in Katrina too. They made money off of fixing the disaster.
Yeah, and that was, you know, that after the 9/11. I mean, that Patriot Act was I don't know, 700 pages, and all of a sudden, bop, it's up there. No, I don't think so. I think the Patriot Act was written long before, you know, 9/11, and that was just a convenient opportunity to spring that on us, and that took a lot of rights. I mean, right now we have people in Guantanamo Bay, and they've been there for almost 20 years, and they haven't had a right to a lawyer in a trial. I mean, this is just like, this was guaranteed with the Magna Carta. You know, we really gotta. I mean, and then we talk about other countries and their rights. It's just like, well, we've got prisoners in there that are basically gulagged, you know.
Right, and we're not quite as bad as China. I don't know if this is true. I heard in China they actually welded some doors shut on apartment buildings to keep people in their apartment buildings during this crisis. So at least we didn't go that far. I don't think people will put up with that here because we've had freedom too long, but it would only take a few generations for people to forget that.
Well, I don't think we have a few generations. I think the way it's going with climate chaos, it's, you know, it's going to get ugly, and it's going to make this look like a walk in the park, having to deal with, you know, the coronavirus, because we just can't shelter in place with the climate change. You've got, you know, once you set things into motion, you just can't, you know, back out of them quickly. It's like turning around a ship. It takes a long time to turn around a ship, and that's what it's going to be. But, you know, we just have all these misleaders, and they're taking us down roads that, you know, we're not going to like, but people keep putting faith in them.
Well, should we vote them out?
Well, either that, or think of some way to replace that methodology, like I was talking about earlier in the community in Mexico that, you know, took over the government. They kicked out the mayor. They took over the police department. That was pretty incredible, because actually in the Mexican Constitution, the police have to put their guns in every night. And so they just went and took the guns away from the police. And, you know, I don't know how they're doing nowadays, but it was just an incredible story about, you know, a community taking itself back and taking back. And And they had a priest in there that was working with them, and the Vatican called the priest back and put in a priest that was, you know, more of to the leader's likings.
Well, now, here's my prediction, too, is I think we're going to make it through this summer that will... The businesses will come back during the summer, but then again, but like you're saying with the Spanish flu, it's going to come back next winter, and they won't have a vaccine. But I think they will have a serum by November.
Well, you know, both the Spanish flu and the Black Plague, what I read about those is that they took about, to play at themselves completely out, it was about 3 or 4 years. And so that could happen with this. And Spanish flu, actually, in some ways, it worked for the workers to a benefit. Of course, you lost, you know, 1/3 to 2/3 of Europe, and that's pretty bad. But then there's so much land, and there's only so many workers. And so the workers after the Black Plague, they actually had more power because it was, you know, supply and demand.
Yeah, and you notice the stock market is not suffering at all. That only suffered for a week.
Oh, it's still doing pretty bad.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure that's going to come back very quickly. Because my point is that the lower classes don't own stock.
Yeah, it's true.
And I will say, though, that people's pensions, I mean, this model, they should change. That's another thing they may have to, probably should change. But, you know, your pensions, I was talking to a guy that's a Teamsters where I work, and he was saying that he was retiring right when the stock market crashed. So his 401k was just wiped out right on the, basically on the day that he had to retire.
Yeah, we used to have pensions, and that was a guaranteed income. And now they tied it, like where I worked, they basically made us go on to they made us go on to a 401k that was invested in the stock market. This city's invested in the stock market. The state's invested in the stock market. So,
well, but a 401k is different. Where if you're in a pension, you're in a much broader spectrum. You have much more people involved in it, and you're spread out over a huge thing. Whereas a 401k, you're basically on your own.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they also, when I worked at this place, I went in there as a low risk, low return, and they automatically put me in the high risk without my consent.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah. Let's wrap it up then. Anything else?
I can't think of anything.
All right. And did you have a song that you wanted to do since you brought your guitar?
It's a little bit too cold for my fingers to work.
All right.
Well, but let's, you know, some other time. Hey, you know, I had this idea, and I don't know what you think of it. I was thinking about, what would it be like if I came in like once a month with some news when we did a media analysis?
Yeah.